17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Flight control mode auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Here with me today on Cosmic Perspective Radio to discuss their new book, Chasing New Horizons, about the amazing mission to Pluto, its moons, and beyond, are co-authors Dr. Alan Stern, principal investigator of the New Horizons mission, and astrobiologist and author Dr. David Grinspoon. Dr. Stern and Dr. Grinspoon, thanks for joining us today on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
Thanks very much for having us on.
Yeah, thanks, Andy.
How did both of you get together? I guess this is a question for both of you. How did you get together and decide to write the book?
Well, I have always loved the story of New Horizons. Even before it was New Horizons, I've been following Alan and his colleagues over the years. I've known them for a long time and have been part of the planetary community and was aware of these guys, this small group that was advocating for a Pluto mission and seemed like they were getting somewhere. And then it seemed like it wasn't happening. And I thought, oh, that's too bad. They tried. And then I learned, oh, well, it is happening because they're trying something else. And there were a lot of twists and turns and ups and downs. And I remember thinking many times, wow, this is a really great story. This will be a really good book someday, you know? I mean, literally years ago, I remember thinking that. And then, of course, the story got better and better because everyone likes a story with some victories as well as some defeats. And then, you know, I was there at the launch of New Horizons, cheering it along with everyone and very caught up in the drama and the excitement of this incredible exploration effort that was happening. And then so when Alan approached me about co-authoring a book with him about this, as someone who loves to write stories about space exploration, that was a wonderful opportunity for me because I love this story and Alan's the person who's lived it more than anyone else. So then we figured out how to write it together with our very different perspectives, him as a participant, me as a narrative. And we agreed that it wasn't just Alan's story, that we would bring in a lot of other participants and weave in their stories. And so just the human drama and the technical ingenuity and the challenges that were overcome, and then ultimately the incredible scientific discovery and excitement of making it to Pluto. You know, it's really a thriller, and it's been a thrill for me to work with Alan in telling the story and now to have it out there so people can learn how it really happened.
From my perspective, there's not a better writer in the planetary science community than David with books like Lonely Planets, Earth in Human Hands, Venus Revealed. And because David also was on such a close basis with so many members of our team and peripherally involved during development and the flight and then actually involved helping us with some of the media work around the flyby, I just thought he was perfect and it just worked out. It's a book unlike any other I think that's ever been written about a space mission. And we're really excited about it for people now to be able to really see the behind-the-scenes story of how this whole thing came down.
It is certainly a book of perseverance, excitement, drama. You could say all that. To tell the story about New Horizons, I guess we really should begin with the discovery in 1930 of Clyde Tombaugh's discovery of Pluto, which I think is an incredible feat in itself. How did Clyde Tombaugh make this discovery in such a short period of time?
Clyde Tombaugh, you're right. It is an incredible story, and it's one that we feel more people should know about. Clyde, he was an American hero and a very skilled person who worked against incredible odds because he grew up very poor on a farm, dreamed of being an astronomer, but had no way, no financial means to go to college or get off the farm. But he studied the sky with his home-built telescopes, and his drawings that he mailed off around the world came to the attention of the Lowell Observatory, and they wrote him and offered him a job. And that was life-changing for Clyde. And then he went to Flagstaff and made the observations, after massive effort and a difficult, seemingly against the odds, of perseverance. And Clyde was an incredible observer. He did something in the 1930s that the rest of the world couldn't really do until the 1990s with much better equipment, which was discover what we now know as a Kuiper Belt object. It's a planet out beyond Neptune. But at that time, it just seemed like another planet. And the fact that he found it then is amazing because it's actually recent history. That's what we love about this story. It's a 20th century discovery that was sort of a prelude to the space age. And Clyde Tombaugh's story weaves through this book in an interesting way. And it sort of adds to the multi-generational historical unfolding of the story because he didn't quite live himself to see the launch of New Horizons to Pluto, but he lived into the space age and participated in many of our missions. And his widow, Patsy, was at the launch. His kids were at the flyby. And there's another poignant detail we discuss in the book, which is that some of Clyde Tombaugh's ashes are on New Horizons. So the New Horizons team succeeded in returning Clyde back to the planet that he had discovered in 1930. And as New Horizons continues its exploration, there's a bit of Clyde Tombaugh heading out into the universe on board the spacecraft. So for us, it's kind of an emotional thing, wanting to share Clyde's story with the world and celebrate his discovery and the connection between that and the modern-day discovery that's happening with planetary exploration as exemplified by the story of New Horizons.
Knowing that Clyde Tombaugh didn't get to see the launch or to know what his discovery looked like, and to know that some of his ashes are on board New Horizons is incredibly inspiring.
There's several parts of the book that people say make them cry. And, we don't want to make people cry, but we like the fact that they relate emotionally to our book, and that's what a lot of people tell us, is that it really grabs them because it's not just a technical story, it's an emotional human story.
It is, and I have to say myself, it made me very emotional at times because it's about people. It is a mission to Pluto, but it's about people. To me, it's amazing that he had this little speck of a light on a plate bounce back and forth, and he was able to see that, and I know I couldn't have found that with a blink compared to
not. He was very skilled and very persistent. When you actually see the pictures, and we show them in the book, the actual plates that Clyde was looking at when he detected that, and you go, man, how did he spot that?
I've read where he used to go into dark closets to dark adapt his eyes. I don't know if those are true stories or not. He certainly was a person of perseverance, and I do recall, and I did have Annette and Al on the show, his children, a few years ago, and did say, you get numb, you get cold, and this can be brutally monotonous, but he did it.
That search had been on for 25 years by prominent astronomers at multiple institutions, not just Lowell Observatory, and no one had been able to pull it off. In fact, there were actually plates taken in 1919 with Pluto on them, but the folks that were doing the data analysis just weren't as good as Clyde. And so even though they actually photographed Pluto moving against the stars, that they didn't know it was there. And Clyde made it look easy. In the space of a year, he figured it out. He never had a false alarm. And he hunted it down. And he found it.
The story of New Horizons has been a story of perseverance, as we're talking about. And although I knew that it took more than 10 years for the mission to be approved, when I was listening to your book, I have no idea what an endeavor it was to get this mission finally approved. I think, Dr. Grinspoon, I think you said at the Discovery Museum a few weeks ago that it all started with a gang of dreamers in 1989.
Yeah, that's right. We traced the very beginning of the effort to marshal support and make a plan to to really make a Pluto mission happen. And 1989 is an interesting year, too, because we relate it to the last Voyager encounter. Voyager had been such an incredible mission, exploring all these planets and moons in the outer solar system, or what we used to call the outer solar system before we knew about the Kuiper Belt. But these incredible flybys that revealed all these worlds and the sense of ongoing discovery. And then in 1989, it was over with the Neptune encounter. And a lot of young scientists who were just kind of starting their careers thought, wait a minute, it's over? We're not going to do more first flybys? You know, that really dramatic sense of new discovery? No, that it can't be over. We want to keep going. And that's where we take up the story of Alan first getting together with a small number of colleagues and deciding, hey, let's convince NASA and convince our community of planetary scientists that a mission to Pluto is worthwhile. Let's figure out how to do this. And they put together a plan starting in 1989. And, you know, things didn't quite go according to plan. And it's a long series of struggles and setbacks and doors slamming in their faces and really having to figure out how the system works. But, yeah, that was the year that the quest began.
Andy, let me just say, never before had individuals in the scientific community simply chosen a destination, a new planet to go visit. This was kind of, it was do-it-yourself space flight. In the past, NASA had set a goal that it's going to go explore Mars, and then it sends spacecraft to Mars and selects a science team, and does the same for every other planet across the solar system. These are NASA-run projects. Never had there ever been a grassroots group that simply wanted to take on a new destination and see it explored, and then succeeded. I don't even know that it had ever been tried. We couldn't find anybody to go talk to who'd ever done this before. So it took us a while to figure out how to do it. We had to marshal a lot of support, but of course, ultimately, we did that.
I just think it's amazing that from the period of time that the mission was approved, then just a little more than 4 years, you had a time frame to beat to use Jupiter as a gravity assist.
Well, that's right. When we finally got selected after a very fierce competition between our team and four others, we came out on top. And this was November of 2001. It was actually the very end of November. It was the 29th of November, 2001. And the only feasible remaining way to get to Pluto with a Jupiter gravity assist was in January of 06, less than four years and 2 months after we were selected. And, you know, you look at missions like Galileo and Cassini, big planetary missions that had been built recently at that time, and they were typically 8, 10, 12-year developments. The thought of having to design, build, test a spacecraft, and get nuclear launch approval in 4 years and 2 months was a very steep challenge. And a lot of people thought we couldn't do it. When we won, I had a lot of people calling me up saying, you won, but you lost, because you've officially become the team that's going to try but not be able to succeed. There's just not enough time to get it all together.
New Horizons was the fastest spacecraft to leave this planet, and with a gravity assist from Jupiter, was traveling close to 1,000,000 miles a day. But New Horizons didn't get a better look at Pluto than the Hubble Space Telescope did than 10 weeks before closest approach. Why did it take New Horizons that long to get a better look at Pluto than the Hubble Space Telescope?
Our best views of Pluto were made with the Hubble in 1994, with an instrument that was a first-generation instrument on board Hubble. And I was the principal investigator of that Hubble project. And we published those results in 1997. NASA had a press conference, and all of the images that you normally see of Pluto made before New Horizons are from that program. Now, what happened 10 weeks before flyby was that we were close enough with New Horizons that our much smaller telescopes could start to exceed what Hubble had done. And so to speak, from that point in time, 10 weeks before in April, on in, we kind of owned it, and every week we would do better and better until we ultimately did quite literally 10,000 times as well as Hubble. We could see things 10,000 times smaller. Hubble could barely see things that were 300 miles across, and New Horizons ultimately saw things that were smaller than 300 feet across.
I'd like to talk a little bit next about the anomaly the New Horizons had. It was pretty much considered a flawless mission until July 4th of 2015.
Yeah, July 4th was probably the most famous day on the mission, except for flyby day. Here we were after 3,300 plus days in flight, and only 3 days from beginning flyby operations, exactly 10 days from closest approach. And owing to a software problem in our main computer, the spacecraft went offline. And we had to call everybody in from the holiday and swing into action, because when we regained communication, we learned that all of the flyby plans, all the software to execute the flyby, dozens of programs and files had been erased in the computer reset. And it had taken us months. We had started, you know, that was July. We had started back in December putting that information up and verifying it was all correct. And here it was, with almost no time to go, completely wiped out, and we had to start over, except we didn't have 6 months. We had 3 days. What ensued thereafter, David and I like to say, is a lot like a scene in the movie Apollo 13, where people were working round the clock, never going home, sleeping under tables and on desks and eating out of candy machines and trying to rescue the exploration of Pluto that was almost snatched from our hands with just days to go.
It couldn't have been more dramatic, really. Literally just hours to spare, the spacecraft was saved by the fact that this team swung into action and really heroically just went beyond what could reasonably be expected, working around the clock and just with incredible accuracy and precision, recreating months of work in a couple of sleepless days to put back on the spacecraft what had been lost in the anomaly, all these files needed so that the flyby could be executed. It was really a cliffhanger, and you know, we tell it that way, and it's a dramatic moment in a long story. We actually start the book with this scene where there's this crisis, and that's how you first meet Alan and meet Alice Bowman, the mission operations manager, and some of these other people. And then we go back and start the story and tell the whole story, and then we catch up to that scene again much later in the book when we're almost at Pluto. So we sort of grab the reader with this crisis and then give the whole long context to how we got there as a sort of a narrative device we use to pull people into the story.
How long did it take to turn it around? Just a few days?
Yeah, it took about, we had something like 78 hours to get it done, or, you know, the start of the flyby, we would cross that boundary. And we managed to do it with 4 hours to spare.
You're listening to Cosmic Perspective Radio. We're going to continue our discussion with the co-authors of Chasing New Horizons, Dr. David Grinspoon and Dr. Alan Stern. Now that we got all this information back, images, data from New Horizons, is there something that stood out that you didn't expect to happen that stands out above the rest?
Well, I have to mention two things. One is just the fact that Pluto is so different from what anyone expected, and in a particular way, a wonderful way, that it's so active and vibrant and, you know, just more alive geologically and more interesting in that sense of being a complex, dynamic world. That teaches us, again, this lesson that we always learn in comparative planetology, that the universe is more clever than we know at making activity in surprising places using the materials at hand. So there's a sort of general lesson that of humility, that we think we've got the universe figured out, and then when we explore new planets, we have to go back and reconsider. And I think that's obviously true about geology, but I think there's a lesson there for biology, too, as far as having expectations of the way things are going to unfold based on the way they've unfolded on Earth. But a more specific thing is that New Horizons has found evidence for a liquid water ocean inside of Pluto, underneath the icy surface, a big reservoir of liquid water deep within Pluto. And that's really exciting for astrobiology, because that means that Pluto could be habitable on the inside. There could be a biosphere in there. And that is not something we necessarily would have talked about that much before the New Horizons encounter with Pluto. And now it's got the attention of astrobiologists as a possible place for life in our solar system.
How does a place that far away, Pluto's surface temperatures are more than minus 300 degrees Fahrenheit, I believe. How does a place that cold, how does it foster an ocean?
Beneath the surface, the temperatures increase with depth, just due to the overlying pressure of the weight of the ice in for this crust. So as you go down from the surface, it gets warmer and warmer and warmer. And eventually, you reach a point where the water ice that forms for those crusted mantle can melt and form that liquid water ocean that David was just talking about. Something that I didn't expect was that the range of phenomenology and the level of activity on Pluto and its satellites that we observed created something I didn't expect, which was a push for more missions to go back to Pluto. I had expected that the first reconnaissance would probably be something like the last reconnaissance because it's such a far away and difficult place to reach. But Pluto was so spectacular that now there are multiple studies taking place of how to do orbiter missions, and also a lot of interest, actually, in exploring other small planets in the Kuiper Belt.
Now that we've had a better look at Pluto, what are some of the similarities between Pluto and other planets?
One thing that people on the team have taken to saying is Pluto is the new Mars. And they say that because Pluto has a surprising range of geography. It's got areas that are brand new and forming today, and vast areas with no impact craters because they're so active and fresh, and then other areas that are really ancient, billions of years old, that are covered with impact craters and have been sitting there in the impact rain for a long time. And also, another Mars-like feature of Pluto is the way the atmosphere and the surface interact. The surface is made out of the same stuff as the atmosphere. A lot of the ice is nitrogen and methane. And so literally the surface materials and the atmosphere are morphing into one another over time. And then there's interesting climate dynamics where the climate shifts and the pressure gets higher and lower over time. All of this we see on Mars and we also see on Pluto. And Pluto has the complexity and the interest to planetary geologists and planetary scientists that Mars holds. Because it's such a surprisingly dynamic place, it's also a red planet. You know, so in all these ways, we find ourselves saying Pluto is the new Mars.
What I find amazing is that really Pluto has something for everyone, from complex atmospheric phenomenology and strong atmospheric cycles that portend vast seasonal changes over long time scales. We have pretty good evidence that Pluto's atmosphere used to be thicker than Mars's. To this global ocean, to glaciers and young terrains and old terrains and clear evidence of avalanches, and that means seismic activity. We have five very diverse moons. It's a double planet. And on top of all that, we see tectonics and we see what look like ice volcanoes on the surface. It really is something for everyone in one small but very potent package. And I don't think anybody really expected that degree of scientific potency.
I understand there are exciting things to come with New Horizons. That New Horizons is closing in on its next Kuiper Belt object.
Ultima Thule, yeah.
When will New Horizons catch up with Ultima Thule?
Well, the intercept is on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2019, just actually on the East Coast, just 33 minutes after midnight. And you watch the ball drop, and 33 minutes later, New Horizons will fly by Ultima Thule three times closer than we were to Pluto. Now that, of course, is just a moment in time. The actual data collection lasts over a period of many days around that date, January 1st. And we actually start the flyby in August with navigation imaging and then hazard imaging. And it's a fairly long approach as we're beginning to study the object and its environment. And then we swoop right down over it New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
Do we have an idea what it's going to look like?
Not much. Nobody's done anything like this. A building block of these planets like Pluto that's 4 billion years old, probably 4.5 billion years old, completely unchanged, we think, since that time, because it's been in a deep freeze near absolute zero all along. So we're just going in with our eyes wide open. We've got seven very powerful scientific instruments, and we're using them to the maximum extent possible on this flyby. And then we're going to ship all that data back, and I'm sure there will be spectacular discoveries.
Does New Horizons have enough fuel and battery power to continue, like Voyager has, basically?
Well, we absolutely can continue on. The spacecraft's healthy, and it has fuel and power to run 20 years or so. after that flyby. The real question for us is whether we're going to be acting primarily as an observatory with telescopes and spectrometers and observing objects in the distance in the Kuiper Belt while the spacecraft remains there, which will be for the next almost 30 years, or whether we have enough fuel on board to eke out one more flyby after Ultima. We won't know that until at least the middle of next year, because we have to know how much fuel we have on board, and then we have to search for possible flyby targets.
One aspect of the New Horizons mission that I love is the fact that it's going to be the fifth spacecraft launched from Earth that will escape the solar system and wander forever. It has enough velocity so that the sun's gravity cannot slow it down. So after it's finished exploring the Kuiper Belt, and even after we lose contact with it, it will keep traveling and wander among the stars forever. A little relic of our civilization that if anybody finds it, they'll know that we were a curious and inventive society, and it will last longer than the Earth, longer than the sun. So that one part of the story of New Horizons is truly eternal.
Dr. Stern and Dr. Grinspoon, thanks so much for joining us today on Cosmic Perspective Radio to discuss this amazing mission, the heart and soul that you both put into this book, and a story about one of the greatest accomplishments in the history of exploration.
Well, thanks very much for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us on your show.
Is there a place where our listeners can go to learn more about Chasing New Horizons and the New Horizons mission?
There are several places. You could check out Alan's website, which is alanstern.space. You can check out my website, which is funkyscience.net. Or you can go to our publisher, Macmillan has a Chasing New Horizons website as well. And if you just Google Chasing New Horizons, a whole bunch of good stuff will come up, and you can buy it, you can learn more about it, you can read some reviews and so forth. It's all over the web.
Dr. Grinspoon and Dr. Stern, thanks for joining me again on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
We're very glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to today's 365 Days of Astronomy podcast. We're going to end today's podcast with a little outro music from Dr. David Grinspoon and the House Band of the Universe. Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Poneros production. And if I don't see you by the next Cosmic Perspective Radio broadcast, clear skies, everyone.
The House Band of the Universe is a band that actually formed to perform in planetariums with cosmic imagery and traveling around the solar system and around the universe. And there's a seventh member of the band who's a visual guy who projects planetarium visuals in real time, jamming with the band visually. And Trip to the Sun is the song that we use for our visuals traveling across the solar system. And I wrote it for that purpose. And by the way, it's in 7/4 time to correspond to the seven celestial objects known to the ancients. So it's basically just a cosmic groove meant to be the soundtrack to traveling across the solar system. And no spacecraft has traveled farther across the solar system than New Horizons.